behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben. As always, we are joined by the legendary super producer, Noel, what's the name of that turn?
How about the Flying Merkel?
Noel, the Flying Merkel Brown, ladies and gentlemen. And this is a show that we're going to start off, as you said, off the air with a question.
Yeah, I've got a question for you. Are you one to attend amusement parks? You ever go to an amusement park?
You know, I haven't in a while, but yeah, I'm a fan of.
When you do go there, and I don't know if this hits you the same way, but yeah. I've been to a lot of amusement parks over the decades. And whenever I go and I see all the rides that are there, the Ferris wheels and all those kids' rides and stuff. But the ones that really impress me are these enormous wooden roller coasters. The structures that are just so complex, when you look at it, you just can't even believe that humans have created something like that.
It's
incredible.
I know what you're talking about, too. And there was one, I don't know if it's still here, in Six Flags over Georgia, which is a U.S. amusement park just outside of Atlanta. And they had a vehicle called the American Scream Machine.
Yeah.
Or a roller coaster, rather. And the thing is, you can hear it creak, and you can hear the give, which the engineers designed as part of it. But do you have time for a quick story?
Oh, of course I do.
All right. That roller coaster, I swear to you, man, I almost flew out of it as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think we've told this story on air, but because once when I was a wee young tyke, my parents met up with one of their friends of the family, and she had two kids. So these three adults and took their three kids to the amusement park, and we all had to sit in this roller coaster. I'm not going to give the name because this might be an unflattering thing, but many years have passed. And because of the way this coaster was constructed, you know, they're like seats of two, two rows, two seats each for each car. Because of just the luck of the draw, I ended up sitting in the same row with the family friend who was much larger and rounder.
Robust. Very
yeah.
robust individual.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And because of this, the bar that pops down and holds
yeah.
your torso down.
I can picture this completely.
Had a lot of empty space
yeah.
Between me and the bar. And at this time, as a kid, I was still kind of frightened of roller coasters. I was pretty young. And we went on this one. I was convinced, I was told it would be fine because there were no loops. It's just a series of very steep, you know, rises and falls.
Oh, sure. How scary could it be?
Right. Well, I don't know how it is if you're in the car for the entire ride. But when we hit the first, and do the physics of those kind of roller coasters, the hill's going to be the first, or the biggest one is going to be the first one, and the rest are going to be a little bit smaller.
Sure.
And so.
And all those weightless times in between.
Right.
Yeah. Zero gravity.
Yeah. And so we hit that first thing, we start going down, and my body goes up and up, and history, of course, makes you exaggerate things. So I used to think it was like down to my ankles holding the bar, but there's no way I could have done that without hitting my face as soon as we hit the bottom. Yeah. But so like my thighs went up, I went up, this poor lady was sitting next to me, screamed and like grabbed me and pulled me back or mm-hmm. tried to. And I thought, oh crap. And I realized they weren't going to stop the ride and there were like five more hills. And so she just had to like grabbed me, and each time I almost flew out of that stupid car.
Yeah.
All to say, I perhaps have a subjective bias against these wooden roller coasters because, you know, some people think they're death machines. Right. I think they're feats of engineering, but, you know, how fast should a vehicle go on wood?
Ah, that's a good question. Now, you know, that's something that we'll touch on that today. We'll touch on the speed aspect of this whole
yeah.
thing. And today's episode is not about roller coasters.
No,
not,
no.
But I wanted to bring in the roller coasters because here's the comparison that I was thinking is that, you know, you're at the amusement park and you're standing staring at this enormous structure, this overly complex looking thing that someone has
yeah.
engineered and put together. And, it's executed quite well, you know, that it works Ooh. Perfectly. It's scary. It's loose. It's fast. It's everything that you want it to be, right?
Right.
In a roller coaster, but, You look at it and you think, like, there's just how do they even imagine something like this out of wood? You would think that, like, that'd have to be a more permanent material.
Sure.
But then you realize, well, back in the day, you know, that was what they used. They just simply used wood to create a lot of different things. Mm. And this goes for racetracks as well. Now, and the reason I'm talking about roller coasters here is that some of these tracks, you know, the coasters are enormous. But some of these racetracks that we're going to talk about today, they weren't just tiny little, you know, little tracks the size of, like, your local dirt track.
Oh, no, no.
Which these replaced, by the way, for some period of time. These tracks, some of them went 2 miles in length, and some of them had just very, very steep banking, which we're also going to talk about. Mm-hmm. Just, can you imagine a 2 mile track that's made entirely out of wood? The whole surface is made out of wood, and the supporting structure all around it, the the grandstands, everything. These had to have been incredibly impressive to see in person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when we talk about steep, just to give you a sense of how steep they were, the grade is a little less than maybe a funnel that you would use, you know, to pour oil in.
Yeah, well, you know what? We're going to talk about banking when we get to it, because I've got some comparisons that I think are going to be real eye-openers when we get to it. But so, Ben, before we get too far into this, I think we need there's a few things we need to explain here. And the predecessor to what we're going to talk about today were velodromes. And, of course, velodromes have been around. There were European velodromes dating back to the mid to late 19th century in the United Kingdom. They were kind of, well, actually really all over Europe for bicycle racing, of course, at that time. And they had very shallow banking in the corners, but they did have bank turns.
Right, and these were, some were exclusively for cycling. Some were also built around athletic tracks or other stuff, right?
And, yeah, and the surface of the track was either made of cinder or shale, or later they made them out of concrete and asphalt and then later tarmac as well. And those were the outdoor ones.
Right.
There were indoor velodromes that appeared maybe in the, let's say, the late 19th century or the early 20th century that were made out of wood. And that is critical in the development of this whole thing. So wooden tracks indoors in Europe, which were for bicycles only, but then motorcycles came around. And motorcycles came around, let's say, let's ballpark this in the 1860s.
All right.
And we're talking about steam-powered velocipedes. And these were these are not the ones that were racing by any means, but they looked a lot like the penny farthing bikes, you know, the the huge front wheel and the tiny rear wheel, but they were steam-powered. So you can imagine how efficient those were and not really a racing
machine.
What could
go wrong?
Yeah, and then they came up with something called velocycles, and they were kind of like a three-wheel design. But those were petrol-powered, and that's important to note because that's 2 years before the Benz Patent Wagon came around, the first car, really, the first recognized car in 1886. So, the, you know, 1884 is when these velocycles emerged, so just prior to cars. And then about 10 years later, let's say, they came out with, like, the first series production, well, they called it a motorcycle at that point. So 1894 is really the first motorcycle, or the first vehicle to be called a motorcycle that looked like a motorcycle, if you want to put it that way. Basically the first commercial product, really, the one that you could go out and buy at your local dealer. And I think that Hildebrand and Wolf Mueller was the first motorcycle, and then it just kind of spread from there. You can find examples of these everywhere, really.
And people love motorcycles and still do.
But the thing is, they weren't really all that fast. They were just a way to get around, and it was a, you know, I don't want to say it was a not a novelty item or anything, but it was different, and it was not for everybody, of course.
Sure.
People are still using horses and carriages and things like
and
that. But
it's expensive to maintain that kind of thing.
But by about 1910, so maybe 15 years later into this whole thing, or even maybe 25 years into this whole thing, depends on where you want to start, motorcycles started to get really fast. People started to realize that, you know, let's cut some of the weight on these. Let's make the wheels pneumatic tires. And, you know, let's up the horsepower. We're going to put a little bit bigger engine in this thing. Just a lot of developments that made motorcycles a racing option. And people were doing that. They were racing them on dirt roads out in the country. They were racing them, you know, of course, where they probably shouldn't be, you know, in town and things like that. But there really were very few track options at that time, if any, for motorcycles. And, I mean, let's be honest, even in 1910, there weren't a lot of car racing tracks either.
Right.
I mean, the cars were using horse racing tracks.
That's a very good point.
You know, dirt tracks. So, anyways, this is where we're kind of starting from here. Right around 1910, and this is a critical time in this history.
Oh, yes, because in 1910, in a place called Playa del Rey, California, the very first U.S. Board track venue is built, and it's called the Los Angeles Motordrome. It is opened in 1910, and sure, it's used for auto racing, but more importantly for the purposes of our show, it's used for motorcycle competition. This was like, if you can imagine the velodrome that Scott described earlier, this was like a version of that on steroids. It was bigger, it was badder, it more importantly had steeper banks.
Yeah, steeper banks for sure. They started with but you know what? Here's the thing about this one. The banking on this one is about 20 degrees.
Okay.
Now that's pretty steep, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's steeper than the really shallow banks of the velodrome.
Should we just get this out of the way right now?
Yeah.
I think we will. Let's talk about banking because we're leading up to this, and I don't want to miss it by any means. So, all right, so 20 degrees of banking on this 1 mile track, right? And this is the very first one, again, the Los Angeles Motordrome. And please take a look online for photos of this thing. You're not going to believe it. It's amazing. So this is the very first board track, again, 1 mile in length, 20 degree banking.
All wood.
All wood. Just to give you an idea of comparison, that's not reasonable banking, I guess.
Sure.
It's not very steep. If you want to look at modern NASCAR tracks, NASCAR competition, which a lot of people can, reference in their head.
Yeah.
You've seen a wreck on Daytona International Speedway, and let's say that the wreck ends up where, you know, the cars slide up to the top of the wall and somehow remain stuck up there.
Mm-hmm.
The rescue teams often have trouble getting up to that wreck because they can't walk on that surface. And the track in the corners is about 31 degrees of banking in the corners at Daytona International Speedway. And the straights, which aren't even flat in Daytona, they're 18 degrees at the start-finish line. So there's always some degree of banking at Daytona. And that's not even the steepest in the whole series. Talladega is the steepest in the series at 33 degrees.
Wow.
So that gives you an idea. And again, watch the crews attempt to climb those banks, and you'll understand how steep 33 degrees is and 31 degrees. You'll get it. So this Motordrome, the first one, again, is 20 degrees of banking, but as we progress through the decades that this is a real thing, a sport, you know, for the next 20 years or so, the banking gets steeper and steeper and steeper. It goes to 30 degrees, 40 degrees, 50 degrees, and then eventually, by the time they built the St. Louis Motordrome, it was a quarter mile track. It had 62 degrees in banking. So that's unbelievable. I mean, you almost have to look it up to understand what that means. But,
right.
You know, look at the wall next to you. That's 90 degrees.
Yeah.
It's not that far off from there.
It's pretty much a lazy wall.
Yeah, it really
but I
is.
Guess the best way to say it is a dangerous
and,
wall.
And adding to this, okay, so, man, there's so much I have to get to on this podcast. But that requires a lot of speed in order to maintain in your position on the track at 62 degrees. Here's another example. You know, a lot of people have seen the Ken Block version where he was in Paris, I think.
Okay.
At one of his Gymkhana videos.
Oh,
and he does some crazy, you know, stunts on these high bank turns. It's not a velodrome. I can't remember the name of the place right now, the venue, but I've got it written down. Maybe I'll find it today at some point. That banking is something like 51 degrees. So
that's it.
Yeah. And again, stand and lean. It looks like it's an optical illusion when he's leaning on his car. It's incredible.
And this does rely on physics because we've covered in earlier episodes that you may have checked out, longtime listeners, some of the motorcycle stunts that you might see in traveling circuses and stuff like that where they get locked into that ball of death and they have to, the drivers have to begin at their low speed with small circles that spiral out and get bigger and bigger and bigger so that they can rely on the speed to give them downforce, essentially.
You know, we've also done an episode on the Wall of Death. And
the
Wall of Death is still something that is traveling. There's somebody that has, I think, the trademark on the name of that. But there are several acts that travel around, and they set up this Wall of Death where they have, you know, a small, like a midget race car.
Yeah.
They have motorcycles, of course, and they all have their own little twist on what makes it interesting. But those are, again, same thing. You spiral around on the small track below, and then at a certain speed, you're allowed to climb up onto that 90-degree surface. This is not that far off from that. And these were, again, enormous tracks that range from quarter or third-mile tracks all the way up to 2 miles in length. Now, the big 2-mile ones, I don't think the banking was quite as steep. I mean, it might have gone up to 50 degrees, but it wasn't 62 degrees.
Right.
This smaller track, this was like a quarter-mile track, I think. And I think when I was reading this, you know, just for reference, I guess, they were saying that lap times at these smaller tracks, sometimes lap times would be like 8 seconds. That's how fast these guys are going around these tracks. Yeah, super quick. So 90 plus miles an hour at some point, but early on in this, in the 1910s or around 1910, speeds were closer to, let's say, 60 or 65 miles an hour, and that was going insanely fast for them at, you know, like the Motordrome.
Right, and there's another thing we should mention here. When we're talking about racing, we're not talking about time trials or something. Not only, and you'll see how insanely dangerous this was in a little bit later in the show, but not only were these people in very dangerous conditions, but they were also in very dangerous conditions maybe inches away from a competitor.
Yeah, that's true. And man, there's so many safety aspects to this whole thing. Let's can we talk about the bikes just for one moment?
Yeah, let's talk about the bikes.
So to start out with bikes, and then eventually automobiles will enter the scene as well. But the bike brands that were there were Indian and Cyclone and Pope and Flying Merkle. There's an old nickname. Norton. There was Harley Davidson, of course. Excelsior. There's just a bunch of these old style motorcycles that look a lot like bicycles, of course, you know, with engines attached, but really, really cool looking machines. And here's the thing that I didn't know about these bikes, Ben. I figured it was just a regular motorcycle you'd find on the street, but maybe, you know, a little faster, a little sleeker, sure. You know, a little built for speed. These bikes, I didn't realize this, they don't have any suspension at all. No travel. No. It's like a bicycle in that way. However, there's also no clutch. There's no throttle. There's no brakes.
Oil just sprays out behind.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It is a, what do they call it?
It's a total loss design.
That's right, total loss. Yeah, I couldn't think of the name of it, but the lubrication system is designed to completely empty itself during the race. So there's another factor into the danger of this, because those boards that they're racing on, the wooden boards, which were really just 2x4s, sometimes on their edge, but mainly just 2x4s.
Yeah, just flat 2x4s.
Those were completely soaked with oil all the time, and bits of rubber and, you know, whatever else embedded itself in there. And, of course, they would splinter. There would be holes, there would be timbers that would be completely knocked loose from the track surface.
Often in the course of, you know, a single race.
Yeah, so, you know, these things with, you know, no clutch, no throttle, no brakes, it was just, you either had, it was like full go and then off. And that's the only speeds, and you could, of course, coast to a stop. But I guess the thought process there is that you have to be full throttle on, otherwise you're not going to stick to the walls. The other thing is, of course, you want it to be full throttle. So it's all engine tuning and, you know, making sure that you got the right mixtures and all that. You know, so it's competitive in that way.
Yeah.
But it's full throttle on or off with a kill switch. And that was your only options.
Right.
And okay. And I said we needed to talk about safety.
Okay.
This is important. So over the decades, because it started again around 1910, and I think the final track was used for, or the end of competition was somewhere in the early 30s, right?
Yeah, like 1931, right?
Yeah, 1931. So it's the, I guess the onset of the Great Depression here in the United States. That's when it kind of killed this whole thing off. But over those decades, there were hundreds of these tracks that sprung up all over the place. Not all of them were you know, AAA national championship tracks, which you can find lists of, you know, where they were and how big they were and, you know, when they were active and all that online. You can find those easily. But some of the smaller tracks are you know, the lesser known tracks. You're going to rely on, you know, going to people's photo books in small towns and looking through what they've got, because it really, the memories are all that exist at this point.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them were destroyed by weather or just by time, the ravage of time, because they required a lot of maintenance. As we mentioned,
what? You know, no way.
lots of maintenance, and it was expensive. They were initially cheaper to build.
Right. Yeah. Just the material was initially cheaper, but it's like, when you buy a car that might have a lower sticker price, you have to factor in the cost of ownership. And the problem was that at least in the case of the Los Angeles Motor Dome, that it took about 3 million feet of lumber and 16 tons of nails to construct what, you know, they called the pie pan, which was the track.
That's unbelievable. Okay, so that was the Motordrome, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that is a 1 mile track, but you're talking about the entire thing. It took about 3 million board feet of lumber to build the whole thing.
Right. 16 tons of
lumber. I've got a number here just for the track surface, because once you build the track, you know, once you get that in place, and I think the ballpark estimate of the price on this track or other tracks similar, you could just give it a round number of $500,000.
Back then?
Yeah, back then in 1910. So the number that I have is for the track surface only. And I think they said for a 1 mile track, it took about 1 million board feet of brand new lumber and a complete set of boards were needed every 5 years or so. So, you know, along the way, you're replacing individual boards here and there, but then there's a point where you realize, like, this whole thing has got to be redone. And that's about 5 years into competition. And, you know, because of, you know, just wear and tear and, you know, the oil soaking and all that stuff. So every 5 years they had to be resurfaced. And the cost of a million board feet of new lumber back in 1910 or 1915, I think, was about $125,000. And today, in today's dollars.
You got that one? Yeah.
$3 million.
Holy
shit. So every 5 years you're going to invest $3 million in the surface of that track. An equivalent of $3 million.
Uh-huh.
So it got to be very expensive and tough to keep up. And then, of course, along the way, there's also going to be other stuff that happens because, boy, we still haven't talked about safety, but the railings are going to get knocked down.
Right.
The stands are going to have, you know, there's going to be broken grandstands.
Mm-hmm.
Wood's just going to wear, you know, because
due
of
the elements.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, you know how it works. I mean, if you have wood outside, it's going to rot away. And they didn't really have the preserving chemicals that we have now, so it wasn't lasting quite as long. I mean, just imagine putting a raw piece of wood out in your yard and see how long that lasts.
Yeah, and let your neighbors know that we told you to do that.
Yeah, yeah, sure. We'll take the heat.
That.
Yeah, right.
So here's a way for us to change tracks a little bit toward the safety aspects. So these things, during their heyday, as their ascendancy rose, they were drawing in massive crowds. This type of racing is one of the most popular forms of racing in U.S. history. We're talking about 80,000 people in Chicago. In Tacoma, which was a relatively small town at the time, it had a population of 83,000 people in 1910, and 35,000 turned out to see a race.
Holy cow. So that's a pretty big draw.
Right.
It means like one in every three people in the whole town, and more than that, one in every three people was attending that race.
And, of course, there are people coming from out of town.
Well, sure, that too. But, I mean, it's a big deal for a small town like that. It's a relatively small town. But crowds of 90,000 people, I mean, that's ballpark what they were getting at, like, the Indianapolis 500 in the early days.
Yeah. So that number was from Chicago in 1915. And here's the thing, Scott. This race in Chicago happened 3 weeks after the Indy 500, and 60,000 people attended that.
Yeah.
So for a time, just for, you know, that's a tricky measurement because it may have just been that one time, but it was more popular than Indy.
Well, it could have been, yeah. And you know what? There's another interesting tie in here. Man, we're not going to get to safety, are we?
We're totally going to get there. I promise.
Well, actually, you know what? This is maybe a good lead in because we talked about how dangerous this is. And over the decades, I don't know if we've even mentioned this or not, Ben, but over the decades, this sport cost the lives of hundreds of individuals.
Yes.
Hundreds. In maybe a 20-year time span.
Because it earned the dubious moniker. People started calling them not motor drones, but murder drones.
Yeah, that was, I'm sure it was for, you know, sell newspapers, probably,
sure.
You know, the damning headlines. But, and there's one accident in particular that we'll talk about that touches on that, but Ben, I'm glad you mentioned the Indy 500 because there's an interesting tie-in, an interesting and deadly tie-in with Indy 500 winners in board track racing.
Oh, do tell.
Yeah, so this is I guess we're getting into car racing as well, you know, not just motorcycle racing, but it's kind of a mix throughout the whole time. Driver fatalities were growing in the 1920s, and in fact, four Indianapolis 500 winners died doing board track racing. So the people that had won the Indianapolis 500 at some point, they perished in board track racing. It was that deadly. It's a difficult race to compete in. Three of these winners that were killed also competed in the Indianapolis 500 that same year. So, and I think in one case it was just a matter of months later. So there was Howdy Wilcox, who died. He had won the 1919 Indy 500, and he died on a race in September of that same year. And then there was a co-winner in 1924 named Joe Boyer, and then the 1929 winner, Ray Keach, all suffered fatalities in the same year as they won the Indy 500. And then later, I guess it was only 17 days after he won the Indy 500, Gaston Chevrolet, who was, brother of Louis Chevrolet, the founder of the Chevrolet motor, well, the brand, really. He died in June of 1929. So that was just, like I said, just a few days after winning the Indy 500, you know, from the top of the world, top of the heap, to dying on a board track.
And the horrific thing about this is that the accidents were not unusual. You know, sadly enough, a lot seemed to occur in August as we record this.
Yeah. And, you know, and it included spectators too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. That's probably why it claims so many lives because, you know, the design of the track, and you know, we mentioned the banking.
Right.
And that, you know, the 62 degrees and even the 50 degree tracks, the 45 degree tracks.
And not much protection for the grandstands.
Yeah.
All.
So they build a wooden rail that's mm-hmm. held, you know, a 2x4 rail.
Right.
That's also held up with other 2x4s. And really that's the only thing separating these guys going 95 miles an hour on a track on a motorcycle with the crowd. And of course they're on that oil slick track. And when you crash in something like this, there's a good chance that bike is going to go up and out of the track. And the rider, and that's what happened often. And of course, there's light poles all around as well for evening
right.
races, and those got knocked over. And there were numerous fires that claimed lives, but oftentimes, you know, the bikes would end up spinning into the crowd and killing many, many people in one shot.
Right,
and
it's
terrible.
I've got one example here. So in July 20th, this is the kind of accident that you had just mentioned, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
There was. A board track in Ludlow, Kentucky, right? A racer named Odin Johnson crashed, and when he crashed, his motorcycle hit a light pole, and the motorcycle's gas tank exploded. An exposed electrical wire from the light pole sparked the fuel and spread the flames into the crowd. So the ultimate death toll was 8 people. And that was the Salt Lake Telegram reported.
Yeah, and then after that accident, of course, you know, Johnson, of course, perished in the accident as well. So I don't know if it was a total of 9 or 8 total, but Johnson's widow then vowed that she was going to spend the rest of her life, you know, making sure that these board tracks were banned. But didn't take too long after that before, you know, they finally were banned, at least from motorcycle competition, which we can talk about maybe later. Do you want to talk about it now, maybe?
Sure, yeah.
All right, so by 1913, they had already decided that these were kind of a bad thing for the sport. I mean, they said,
yeah.
You know, maybe we should just go back to dirt track racing like we had before. And by 1913, there was already a move to kind of push it in that way. And that's following the death of a very famous rider who was only 19 when he died. The guy's name was Eddie Hasha, which was he went by the Texas Cyclone. That was his
mm-hmm.
name. So, you know, early on, he's a young guy. He's already got this nickname, the Texas Cyclone. What a cool name.
Yeah.
But on September 8th of 1912, he was killed at a motordrome near Atlantic City. I think the town was something called like Nutley, I think is it? It's like 2 hours away.
Okay.
But in that accident, 4 spectators were also killed and then 10 more were injured. And, of course, they made the front page news of the New York Times. And that's when they started calling these, you know, the shorter tracks, the quarter mile and the 1/3 mile circuits, the murder drums.
Mm-hmm.
So the murder drum term comes from this very accident. It started with that. And that's early on. That's 1912. And remember the Los Angeles Motodrome opened in, what, 1910?
Yeah.
So that's only 2 years later, and they're already getting this nickname. And these are going to hang on for another 20 years after this. So
yeah, and the place where the Texas Cyclones accident occurred had only opened that same year in July.
Yeah,
and they shut down afterwards.
It had already claimed so many lives of riders and spectators as well. And they just realized this is just a super dangerous sport. We can't really, you know, sanction this type of thing.
So that's when the smaller ones began to close.
Well, they started to. And by 1913, the motorcycle championship races were moved to a dirt track because dirt was considered a safer surface at that time. So it's a different type of racing, sure, but they moved it to a dirt track. And the organization that oversaw motorcycle racing eventually banned all competitions on board tracks shorter than 1 mile in length by 1919.
And then another problem that beset the place, I just want to enter this as a side note so we can remember it when it comes up because it'll come up several times. When you look at the history here, another unfortunate occurrence that would befall motordromes is that they would catch on fire.
Yeah, that's true. And, of course, what are you going to do? I mean, it's untreated lumber.
The bikes are spewing oil.
Yeah, that's true. The track is oil-soaked. There's gasoline, of course. There's electricity there.
Yeah.
The crowd, which is probably going to panic and try to get out. I mean, even if it's a small track, let's say there's 5,000 people there. I think there's one account of, you know, there was panic when, you know, fire happened in one place, and they said it took an hour to get 5,000 people out of one of these motor drums. That's how long it took. And imagine if the whole place was engulfed. I think they had that one under control. I know spectators perished in that one, but not as many as it could have, you know, could have happened. But imagine a huge speedway that's got 90,000 people. And the whole thing's connected, of course, you know, with the structure underneath. Mm-hmm. All of that could catch fire. And I know that, you know, they were able to isolate, you know, the fires and keep some of that to a minimum. But there were just some horrific, horrific things that happened during this era. And you know, there's cars that enter the scene as well. Now, imagine if a motorcycle flies off into the crowd. That's awful enough, right?
Yes.
If a car flies off into the crowd, it's going to the damage becomes exponentially more or more serious, I guess, mm-hmm. because you know, just the size of it and the weight and the, you know, it's just unbelievable what these crowds went through to watch these races. I mean, it was like taking your life into your own hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's quite literally what it was. We cannot overemphasize how popular these things were. And Scott, you and I were talking off air earlier about, you know, I guess the best way to say it would be the nature of morbidity, how no one admits that they slow down at accidents, but statistically, most drivers do, and not because of traffic, but because of rubbernecking.
Yeah.
Now, of course, ladies and gentlemen, drivers and shotgun passengers alike, and shout out to you in the back seat if you're listening in the car.
You're so inclusive.
I'm not trying to say in any way that the majority of these fans were there for that kind of Schadenfreude. I'm saying that statistically it's likely there was a contingent because something about the possibility of that draws people.
Yeah, that's so true. But it's also the greatest competition that they're going to see. You know that
right. This is still a world of horse carriages.
Exactly. And this is going to be really, really interesting. It's going to be like the only show in town probably on the weekends. So, you know, why not go to something like this? It's the, you know, the choice is either that or hang out on the front porch and watch the traffic go by.
Yeah, it's, I mean, what kind of traffic, too?
Oh, well, early cars, I guess, right?
Well, hopefully. There might be a few in your town. Yeah, if you're maybe in a big city, there are probably several.
Probably. And, you know, these were in big towns everywhere. It seems like most of the major towns here in the United States had a motordrome of some kind. And you'll find no traces of them today, practically. Maybe some satellite photos that indicate, you know, where they were at one time. But that's about it. Because the wood structures, they're just gone.
And we have some side notes we want to get to on this. Because we had no – I don't know about you, man, but I had no idea how prominent this was in American culture.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, for motorcycles at first, then auto racing, and then for a time, a mix of both. You know, there'd be cars and cycles racing at the same time. Not together, but I mean, you know, on the same weekend, maybe. So here's a couple of side note things that, and I'll just throw these out there and see where we go with the discussion, but it's kind of like the wrap-up of the whole thing, really. So one thing that I stumbled across as we were reading about this is, of course, you know, track maintenance and, you know, how difficult it was to maintain these as, you know, the vehicles were really rough on the surface, very difficult on the track surface. So one thing I found is that during the last decade of board track racing, carpenters would sometimes repair the tracks from below while the race was happening above. So like a timber gets shaken loose,
what? They
climb underneath the structure, you know, because you can imagine these are elevated. You know, they've got a heavy wooden structure below. They would repair and, you know, reinsert boards from beneath when they were missing because timbers would sometimes go missing and they'd have to get out there and take care of it during the race. Incredible, isn't it?
Insane.
Yeah, because, you know, we're talking about the end of the era and speeds are above 100 miles per hour. You know, they're 120 miles per hour in some cases. And there's a carpenter underneath there trying to slip a board into place, into position. And I don't know what that really entails. I don't know if it was like a, you know, a tongue and groove type situation or, you know, what was really involved in replacing one. If there was hardware involved or
right.
what.
Or the extent of the time it would take to install one. Which, I don't know. See, everything that we're learning about this is that each lap becomes progressively more dangerous because the track is getting damaged. It's getting soaked in oil. The drivers are probably eventually going to encounter fatigue because let us not forget that the LA Motordrome did do a 24-hour endurance run.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they were they did their first 24-hour endurance race in 1911.
Wow!
And in May of the same year, Texas Cyclone set a new record there when he hit 95 miles an hour.
Oh, so there's – okay, he built his name there then.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And so this was still, you know, they had some autos in there. But whether it's a 24-hour endurance with a car or a motorcycle, that's something that should not have happened. I hate to be, you know, a Debbie Downer. I guess maybe a bummer Ben would be more appropriate.
I like it.
But that's the kind of thing where it's a danger to the people in the stands, the people in the vehicles. And now, come to find, because I did not know that, the carpenters beneath the track.
Yeah. It's like everybody's in danger. Every single person there is in danger. But interesting. Okay, so here's another one, Ben.
Yeah.
There was a guy named Jack Prince. I don't know if you read about Jack Prince or not, but this was the guy who traveled the country enthusiastically selling board tracks to all kinds of driving groups and municipalities on the way. Uh-huh. So this is the guy that goes into town and he gives like the big presentation, you know, kind of like the monorail salesman on The Simpsons.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Monorail.
And then, yeah, exactly. And he's got the whole thing laid out, you know, like what it's going to look like, a model and everything, you know, and tells him the cost. It's $500,000. And, you know, the townspeople say, no, no way. I don't want that. And then, as he's walking away, he probably said something like, well, I guess this is more of a Shelbyville kind of idea. So, yeah, it's got to be something like that. But this guy, he sold a lot of tracks. And, of course, you know, the benefit to a lot of these small towns was that it kept their labor force working.
Kept labor force working, also provided a huge boost to the economy because surrounding towns would all hear about maybe the big race on Saturday and then boom, you know,
well,
local restaurants sold out. People are sleeping at the motor lodge.
Yeah. And it's something that they can, you know, keep going for years and years and years, you know, aside from the construction. And, you know, of course, when the construction's happening, it's going to take several months to complete with lots of labor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's going to be the biggest construction project probably in the entire state when it's happening. So it's going to be a big draw for this town. It's going to put it on the map, really. So even if it's a smaller town, they're gonna profit from it if they can come up with the money ahead of time. But this Jack Prince guy, he's the one who went around and sold a lot of these tracks, and he worked with a guy named Art Pillsbury.
Very important name.
Now this is a guy who designed tracks, and he would design a track. He did design a track in Beverly Hills, California, with a different type of turn. Now prior to this, they were just kind of, well, I guess not winging it. They were engineered all along, but, you know, so that they were a smooth transition because I think some of the early ones were a little rough. They said, you know, you go from the straight into a bank turn like that, and it was almost like you're hitting a wall. You know, they're very, very steep and you almost smack into it. So Pillsbury started engineering these tracks in a different way, and he created something called the Cyril Spiral Easement Curve. And it was designed for improved handling and speed, of course. But it would load the cars up with G's, or the motorcycles with G's.
G-force.
So, riders would experience up to 2 G's at 100 miles an hour on these tracks. And the reason that these were so effective or so important for the design of, you know, the tracks going forward is that they created, I don't know how to best say this. You can call it the track transition curve, maybe. And yeah. I'll try to describe this. It's that if you were going at a certain speed at a certain line, the corner takes over the steering of the vehicle for you. You can let go of the wheel, and the car will make it completely through the turn, and you're back onto the straight again.
Right, and that's due to the you're right. It's a trans. It's that track transition, essentially.
Yeah, with no steering input from the driver, the car will make the turn completely. And again, it's because of that banking, because of the design of the curve. It's it's engineered perfectly so that it would work that way. And I've heard tales of of course there are manufacturer test tracks that have turns like this.
Right.
This exact same turn that was designed by Art Pillsbury.
And there are, you know, this is something that happened in railroads as well.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's part of why they can, make the turns that they do and hang on the track, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. At a much smaller scale. I mean, less banking.
No, it's true. They were racing full-size locomotives on these tracks.
All right, point taken.
No, I'm kidding. You're right.
So it's a method to keep the vehicle on track or, I guess pointed in the right direction at all times.
It may well have saved lives.
I would say that it probably did. But again, the first one to use that was in Beverly Hills, California. And that was, again, an Art Pillsbury track. All right, so another couple of quick things here before we wrap up, and I know there's going to be more that we'll find when we're done. But there's a guy that wrote a book called Wall Smacker, and this leads to the other more interesting part of this. But I have not read Wall Smacker. That might be the best book I've ever read, but I'll find out soon because I think I'm going to pick this one up.
Yeah, cool.
But it's by former driver Peter DiPaolo. and he was a car driver, not a motorcycle driver, but this guy happens to be the nephew of Ralph De Palma. And Ralph De Palma is a famous race car driver.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you about Ralph in just a moment, but this book, Wallsmacker, is all about Peter De Palma's time as a board track racer back in the, right in the heyday of this whole thing. So he's got some great tales, and, he talks about, the great sensations of dodging holes and flying timbers and, the splinters in the face and all that stuff, because these guys would get just horrific injuries sometimes from the wood surface, when they would wreck.
Yeah.
And, one thing we haven't even talked about in safety was that the steep banking sometimes meant that if a rider fell off his bike, he was likely to be struck by his own vehicle
as it fell without.
Yeah, they would fall, 15, 20 feet to the bottom of the track, and then the bike would come down and hit him. It was like just a double whammy, I guess. And of course, the bike traveling across the traffic would sometimes take out other riders. In fact, one of the cases that we mentioned, I think, I don't remember if it was the Hasher wreck or not, but his bike took out another rider and eventually killed him. So the steep corners, all played into that whole thing. And this guy, so he's Peter De Palma. He is the nephew of Ralph De Palma, as I mentioned earlier. And now De Palma, he's an interesting cat, and I think he may be someone that we could talk about in a full podcast someday.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Time he was racing was the early 1900s up until I think he made an appearance like as a track official at Indy in the 1950s. But that was it. And I think the guy lived until the mid-1970s or somewhere in there. But he was racing right again in the board track era. And he was also, he was a car racer. He was a motorcycle racer, a little bit of both. He's probably better known for his auto racing. And of course, he was the eventual winner of the Indy 500 in 1915. He held world speed records in a Packard on Daytona Beach, Ben. Packard.
Yeah.
On the beach, on the sand.
He
had an on the sand record. Something like 150 miles an hour on the sand in Daytona. Yeah, in 1919, I believe it was. He's a member of several Hall of Fames. Just an all-around good guy because everybody liked him. They said he was a good sport on and off the track. He would take responsibility if he caused an accident. He would say it, it wasn't the other driver's fault.
Mm-hmm.
He would do things like, I think before one race, a young boy was starting his race car, and it was a hand crank car, and the engine kicked back and broke the boy's arm right before the race. Now, so then the guy, De Palma, went on to win that race, and they said that instead of taking the podium, and accepting the cup for the victory, he went to the hospital and sat by the boy's bedside, with him as he was, being bandaged up.
What a good person.
He was. Yeah. He's a good guy. And they said there's just countless tales of him like that. So he's a really good guy. And what he's probably most famously known for, and we'll wrap it up on this, I guess, maybe, is that he famously lost the Indy 500 in 1912. But what came from this was a lot of photos came from this, really, that are famous photos of he and his riding mechanic pushing his car across the finish line in order to collect the winnings from that race. Even though he finished 11th, his car gave out on him after he had led something like 196 laps of the Indy 500.
Uh-huh.
On lap 198, with just two laps to go, his car conks out of him. It's a Mercedes. I think he had a cracked piston or something. He and his mechanic had to get out and push the car across the finish line in order to finish the race and collect the money that they were due. But the crowd was like 90,000 at this point. And the crowd was cheering louder for them pushing the car across the line in 11th place than they were for the winner of the race, who was almost forgotten to history now. Not really, but almost compared to what had happened there. And there's famous photos of him and his riding mechanic. The guy's name was Rupert Jeffkins. And this car was like, 2,500 pound car, something. It's an enormous racing Mercedes that they're pushing across the line on the bricks.
And so this guy is also, let's see, he was still winning awards. He got his one of his most recent awards was in 2006.
Yeah. Well, it was posthumously.
Yeah.
Of course.
Posthumously.
So 40 years after, he's still winning awards.
Right.
And, Ben, here's the last little bit on De Palma here. And this is a bit gruesome, though.
And I think we should do it.
The same year that he famously lost the 500, the 1912 race, the series went on to Milwaukee next. And I don't know where that falls in the series now, if it's still the same way or not. But they went on to Milwaukee. And this will give you an idea of the era here.
Yeah.
So he goes off track. The car goes off track because of an incident, and the car flips over, and he's out in the middle of a cornfield when it flips over. That's how the early days of racing,
wow.
I guess. It wasn't surrounded completely by grandstands. So he's flipped over, and he's in a cornfield, and when he flipped over in his car, of course, he's thrown out because, he doesn't have a seatbelt. There's no seatbelts, and, the leather cap. He's impaled on two corn stalks in that cornfield, and they kept him out of racing for 11 weeks while he's in the hospital being, you know, bandaged up for this thing.
Jeez.
Can you imagine being in a race car? You're 1 minute you're racing in Milwaukee, you know, on the racetrack. The next minute you're impaled on two corn stalks out in some field somewhere. He probably doesn't even remember it, but, man, an 11-week recovery, and what a horrific injury, too. I mean, that could have ended his life right there, but he went on to race, you know, a long time after that. In fact, he, you know, won some big ones after that.
Mm-hmm.
But man, what, there's story after story after story like that in this series. You'll find, a lot of really interesting characters. And I think in that book, Wall Smacker, which I am definitely going to pick up and read, mm-hmm. I think you're going to find, you know, hints, I guess, at other interesting people like that that maybe we can dig into on this podcast.
And the world of board track racing, like the old T.S. Eliot poem, ended not with a bang, but with a whimper, as one by one. Now, Scott, as you said earlier, national organization overseeing bike racing banned all the board tracks shorter than 1 mile, 1919.
Yeah.
And this continued on until about 31, as we said, but the entire time, one by one, manufacturers were slowly withdrawing their support because no one wants to be known as, you know, as the automaker behind the or the bike maker behind the most successful death machines in America.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I guess the timing is just, it worked out so that, you know, as the manufacturers pulled out of the competition, out of the series, and the racers and you know, the racers were probably still wanting to compete because it was big money back then. I think some of the purses were, you know, in the $25,000 range at the time. And that was, you know, ballpark. If you want to put that into today's perspective, that's like $500,000 or $600,000 that could be won on a weekend back in 1910 or 1915.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. That was a huge draw for the racers. That's why they did it. And
right.
Of course, you know, the thrill, of course.
And they were, you know, they were well aware of the risk, but also, also, there's one thing I don't think we mentioned, which is important for anybody who's a fan of the race. So as the speeds increased, and this was something that goes along with my earlier statement that each lap was more dangerous than the last, as the speeds increase, it became more and more difficult to overtake other vehicles.
Mm.
So the fastest car would almost always win the race, you know, as long as it kept on the track.
Well, that's the thing. They said, of course, there's, you know, quality issues because the cars didn't always make it to the end of the race or the bikes didn't always make it. You know, there's a mechanical failure.
Right.
Or, you know, of course, an accident. You either crash out or your bike would fail you.
Right.
So the fastest one, like you said, very little passing in the later days. And honestly, would you really even attempt passing in something like this? I mean, it's like, well, my bike's just not quite as fast. I'm not going to really pull any kind of crazy move. I'm just going to stay in it. I'm going to try to win the prize money for third place.
Right.
And be happy with that and walk away with my life from this one. Maybe next weekend I'll push it a little more.
Imagine by the second lap knowing what place everybody's going to be in. As a racer, that's going to be completely irritating. As a spectator, you know, maybe people eventually got tired of that too.
Well, maybe, I guess.
I doubt it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's tough to say because, you know, of course you're thinking that, well, there's going to be either human error, there's going to be, you know, mechanical failure, as we said. So there are things that can change that, but you're right. Once, after you get into two laps and you settle into the racing groove, you kind of knew who's going to win that 8-lap race.
So now I've got a question for you, my friend.
Oh boy, I think I know.
I'll ask an easy one.
Okay.
Are you for it or against it?
Oh, okay. That's not what I thought.
I was going to ask if you would do it.
Yeah, exactly.
No way.
you have to be out of your mind to do something like this. But people still do this today. There are vintage leagues that do it, but I don't think it's quite as competitive, quite as cutthroat as it was back then.
Mm-hmm.
Spectators aren't killed normally at the historic events. Yeah, I guess, Ben, I'm going to have to say that I am for it. I think that it helped the series grow. You know, it helped, you know, motorcycle racing gain popularity and auto racing, of course. But would I be for bringing it back today, you know, in the form that it was then? No way. There's no need to do that. We've got much safer tracks now.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And the technology, both in terms of track construction and material science, as well as auto engineering, is far, far beyond what we have. I mean, we're looking at life a century later.
Yeah.
And it's weird to think about it in those terms. But what that means, in a fortunate way, is we can have exciting races where it can still be any driver's game and everyone can walk away after.
Oh, yeah. Don't get me wrong. I would love to see a board racing track that, you know, where people are really competing, where they're in true competition, but yeah, much safer than what it was back then, because you can't be losing a rider every weekend and 10 spectators. That just can't happen now. I mean, it shouldn't have happened then. I understand why it happened, because there was no other way around it. They didn't have a better, you know, the safer barriers. They didn't have, the thought that maybe the crowd shouldn't be perched over top of the railing as they're, you know, the riders are going 95 miles an hour just feet away from them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different world, really. It was a danger, and everybody knew it when they went there. You took that risk. But then again, like, you know, you hear incidents where, you know, a 4-year-old or 4 or 5-year-old was killed because a motorcycle hit him in the head because the kid was curious and had his head sticking through the rail.
I will admit, despite the at times gruesome history, that if I were the same age now, or if I were a kid back in that time, I would have done anything to go see this. You know what I mean? Because these are amazing machines, and the chance to see one up close performing at its utmost ability is a fairly profound opportunity.
Biggest show in town. Yeah, at the hands of professionals, too. You know, I mean, it's the top writers that you're reading about in the newspapers every week.
Yeah, and you can find a lot of information about board track racing, both online, in print, and their photographs.
Well, there's even film of these, and man, does it look exciting, and oh man, I would love to be able to go and see a 2-mile track made out of wood. How cool would that be?
Yeah.
It's just something that just doesn't exist. It's just not anywhere right now. Smaller velodromes, sure, and they're impressive, but nothing like that.
Except no substitutions, ladies and gentlemen. And speaking of shows, I think this is going to draw our show to a close before we hit too hard on the banks of this podcast. The podcast studio, of course, as longtime listeners know, is composed of a series of tracks and banks. We have lost a few good people on them. I don't mean that they died in any way. I mean, they got lost. And with this, we would like to point you in the direction of carstuffshow.com, where if you haven't checked out yet, you can listen to many more of our motorcycle and racing related episodes. We have stuff about the history of the evolution of the motorcycle. We have stuff about some of the greatest moments in racing and some of the strangest races across the planet. Let us know what you think about board track racing as well. Were you one of the people who had access to photographs of this from someone in your family, maybe, or have you been to the old sites?
Yeah, the long gone tracks, you know, the ones that were knocked down in a tornado or a hurricane or a fire or something like that. But you know, there's just no other record of them other than, again, in you know, small town scrapbooks.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's where some of them live.
And if you have them, feel free to send them in and we'll share them with the fellow listeners out there. And also, if you happen to be on Twitter or Facebook, you can check out a lot of cool car stories that for one reason or another may not make it to the air, such as one guy I'd actually like to do a story on in the future. I'll just say the word, spoiler alert, Graham.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, we might check that out. You can find these kind of behind-the-scenes looks on our Facebook and Twitter, where we are CarStuffHSW. And if you have a story about board track racing, if you have a suggestion for a topic we could cover in the future, you can write to us directly. We are
CarStuff@HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.